want to invite you to reach for your handout. It's ordinary time. We're done with the church year proper, which begins in Advent and then ends with Trinity Sunday. And we've spent a lot of time looking at the stories of Jesus. Stories that began with Advent, the expectation of Christ, all the way to Christ's teaching, Christ's life, Christ's example, and then Christ's death and resurrection on our behalf, and then our understanding of the Trinity. All of those came to us by way of stories. But now for the summer, during ordinary time, we're going to leave stories. And we're going to move to a certain section of Scripture that is not about a story, but instead it is about teaching us how to live within the story of God. Teaching us what the wise way of living is if we're going to embrace that good news, that story of God in Christ that we embrace. How to live wisely, to walk well, to live a blessed life, which is what Proverbs is all about. Proverbs understands very simply sometimes overly simplified, that there are many ways to live. There are many choices we can make. But Proverbs, unlike our modern culture, understands quite clearly that not every way is a good way. There are choices that we make that help us flourish and that lead to others' welfare. There are choices that we make that are destructive, both self-destructive and destructive to the lives of others. And thus, Proverbs suggests that we need a guide. We need a wisdom that will lead us to make the right choices, wise choices, in a world that offers us so many dead ends. Wisdom does it by showing us two paths, and again, overly simplifying, but in order to make a point, that there is the way of the wise, there's the way of the fool. There's the way of the righteous, there's the way of the wicked. There's the way of blessing, there's the way of curse. There is the way of life, there is the way of death. It sets before us stark contrast so that we can see quite clearly, yes, there's many paths we can go down, but the question is this the wise path, the righteous path, the blessed path, the life-filled path, or is this a life of destruction, a dead end that leads to skid row, a choice that will lead to my own undoing if I follow that path to its ultimate end? I hope you're with me on the fact that if there's a wise way, then there are certainly foolish ways. If there is a way that leads to life and to truth, there are also dead ends. And I hope you're with me not only because Proverbs speaks that way, but Jesus does too. I hope you followed as I read the passage from Jesus' end of the Sermon on the Mount. Some people hear things like, the way of the wicked leads to destruction, as they say, you know, that's Psalm 1, verse 6. That's kind of how the Old Testament rolls. It just kind of gives us that language. But Jesus says the same kind of things. Enter through the narrow gate, the gate's wide, the road this is easy that leads to destruction. So he uses the language of wisdom literature, the language of two paths, and he does it because he knows there are right choices and good paths, there are wrong choices with bad ends. And both he, as well as the wisdom writer, wants to keep us from the foolish, destructive, dead ends. But in order to do that, we need to be aware there are dead ends. So we're beginning with Psalm 1 and not the Proverbs for a specific reason. If you notice Psalm 1, it's really just an extended proverb. It really is just a proverb that is extended in the context of beatitude or blessing that says there are two paths, there are two ways to live. There's a good path and then there is a bad path. There's the blessed life and then there's the way of the wicked that leads to disobedience, sin, and death. And the psalmist, at the beginning of the hymnal of the people of Israel, wants to say, if you're going to worship God rightly and truly be called God's people, you need to affirm that you're committed to the wise way. And in doing that, you need to denounce the dead ends, the ends that lead to destruction. And the psalmist does all of this by highlighting a word that captures the fancy of Old Testament Israelites. It doesn't capture our attention as much as it did them, but it should. He uses the word blessed. Do you see verse 1? That's the carrot on the end of the stick at the very beginning of his proverbial psalm. He wants us to see that there is a blessed way. Now, this is the New International Version translation. I don't normally use the New International. I normally use the New Revised Standard. I didn't use the New Revised today. You know why? Its first word is not blessed. it's happy. Happy are those. And the reason why I didn't is because happy does not have the fullness, the robustness and richness that blessed does. In the ancient world, blessing had to do with not just being happy, it certainly overlapped with that, but with this sense of living under the divine gaze of approval. It's Father's Day today. And if you've been a father at any time in your life or a parent, you know that there are times when you just fawn over your children. You're looking at them with this wonderful, approving gaze because they're playing well, they're behaving well, they're doing the right thing, they're eating the right foods, they're making the right choices. And you just delight. Your gaze is one of approval. But if you happen to see your kids taking the paint and slashing it across the walls, or you see your kids hitting one another in the back room, or you see your kids giving the broccoli to the dog, you don't have that divine gaze of approval anymore. Doesn't mean you don't love them. It doesn't mean you don't want them to be blessed. It means that you know the behavior they're involved in is not good. It won't benefit them. It's not deserving of the gift of life they've been given. And so you look not with this approving gaze of adoration and delight. You look with this gaze of time out or whatever form of punishment or challenge you use. And I hope you use some. Otherwise, you have a little rapscallion by the end of the day. You use something to say, I don't approve. I'm not looking at you with favor. I might still love you, but what you're doing is wrong and I disapprove heartily. That's the idea behind blessing. The great blessing that came from the Levitical priest at the end of every worship service that Israel had is this threefold blessing before you. It's a poem, which means every line adds to the meaning. The priest would end by saying, "The Lord bless you and keep you." Well, what's bless mean? The Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. And again, that's the idea of the divine gaze of loving approval, heartily endorsing the choices that have been made, the thoughts that have been thought, the behavior that is on display. It is sitting under the divine approval. Now, isn't that so much more than happiness? So much more robust? You know, happiness and blessedness can overlap, but blessing is better. Let me give you the best example I know of. In about the last 100 to 120 years, we have a way of saying things that anyone prior to then would never have said. If you ask any parent, including me, because I'm in the last 100 years or so, what do you want for your child? As a parent, what do you want most for your child? Here's what we say, whether we say it thoughtfully or whether we just say it because everyone else says it. I want my child to be happy. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But no one before 1900s would say that. If you ask them, what do you want from your child? What do you want for your child? They'd say, I want them to be wise. I want them to have good character. I want them to be a person of integrity. I want them to be blessed. I want them to be someone who is good. Because you know, you can be happy and still be foolish. There are happy thieves. There are happy rapists. There are happy, you know, just fill in the blank. There's all kinds of people doing behavior that's destructive to themselves and destructive to others, and they're happy. So the issue isn't happy, the issue is being wise, having character, knowing God's blessing, experiencing the approving gaze of God. That's what is at the heart of what it means to be on the right path. Well, with that in mind, let's look at our psalm. Because our psalmist wants us to go down the right path, to know wisdom's way and to know the blessing that comes with it. But in order to show the right way, and this is where we flub up as postmoderns and contemporary people, you have to admit there's a wrong way. You have to admit that there are many wrong ways. Because if there's a right way, then there's by default wrong ways. If we're going to say there are wise ways, we must then say there are foolish ways. And what our psalmist wants to do to show and extol the virtue of the right way, the wise way, is to show you the dead ends. To show you how even good people drift into being fools. And here's how it happens. Verse 1, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers. The King James says, blessed is the one who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. I've been a Christian for, let's see, I'm 53, I converted at 22, so 31 years. So go back 25 to 31 years. The way I would have read that back then would be like this. Don't be involved in the counsel of the ungodly. So don't smoke, don't drink, don't cuss, don't chew, don't be an atheist. You know, all those things which are pretty obvious. You know, it'd be reduced to, I'm sticking out of the counsel of the ungodly if I just stay away from the things that are really obviously detrimental and bad. But as I've walked with Christ, I've come to realize that the counsel of the ungodly is more pervasive than those small, petty things. It is so much bigger because it pervades the air we breathe. We are hearing it every time we turn on the radio and watch the TV and read the comments and sometimes post comments. It is the air we breathe. And let me give you an example of some of the counsel of the ungodly. Things like this. Live as if you're the center of the world. Not a creature made in God's creation called to love God and to follow God, but live as if you're the master of your own destiny, answering to no one but yourself so that any wisdom you have is all self-generated. It's what you've decided is wise. Or counsel like this, you're what you own. Your possessions define the value you have. Or your success is measured by the money you make, the status you have, the acquisitions that you've come into, and the fame that is yours. Or that your body shape and its function or lack of function determines your value. Or that only youth matters and old age is something to be ashamed of, so anyone that's older than 50, 60, 70, instead of acting like a wise sage, needs to act like a full of hormones 18-year-old again. Or the counsel of refusing to respect those with whom we disagree being deemed as virtuous. Or, even worse, demonizing those with whom we differ is somehow justified. Writing them off. Just completely saying they're not even worthy of living. I could go on and on with all the different counsel of the ungodly that permeates and pervades everything we do. Because it's the air we live in, that I live in. We turn on our television, we go online, we listen to the radio. It's so pervasive, we rarely notice it. And thus, like the psalmist says, don't walk in it. We find ourselves just easily walking in it. And as we're walking in it, the influence grows. It becomes more of an impactful thing in our lives. And let me show you how the psalmist develops that. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked or stand in the way. So the next step is first you're walking and you can't help but walk in this atmosphere. We have to be in the world but not of it. And we have to engage with the world and understand where it's coming from, but know that we are seeking a narrow way, a righteous way, a wise way. But trouble comes when we stop and instead of walking in it, we're now standing in the way that sinners take. Our thinking's been influenced, and our perspective's infected, and we've begun to conform. We're going to hang out with this group, with all of their ungodly ideas, and let them influence us. And then the worst step of all is the final step, does not walk, does not stand, or sit in the company of mockers. Here's the best definition of sitting I've seen, Dallas Willard. When I sit down, I'm not going anywhere. I've just decided this is where I'm going to stay. And that's what can happen in life. You walk in that way and then you stand there and then you sit down there. Nobody plans to do it. Nobody plans to go on a destructive way. It just happens. It's the drift of the world. So you see the progression. First you're just walking in it. Then you're standing, being conformed to. Finally you just settle in. Yeah, these are my people. These thoughts will be my thoughts. The things they do and the behaviors they have, even if it leads to a dead end and I know it's destructive and it's not the way of God, I'm just fine right here. I'm going to sit and listen for hours as they despise those with whom they disagree. And I'm going to sit and listen for hours as they scorn people who are not like them. And I'm going to, we're just sitting, we're hanging. That's the dead end. The psalmist wants to say that's not the blessed way. That's the wrong way. But like all gospel-y wisdom, there is a good news. There's the wrong way, but then there's the beautiful right way. Verse 2, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord. Do you know you only delight in things which you love and treasure and value? If you don't love something or treasure it or value it, the reason why I delight in the Scriptures is I love to wrestle with the truths of God. But I have other delights. The reason why I delight in Dream Theater or Carp Tree or Saga or Moon Safari and all the bands I love is because I just value it. I treasure it. The reason why I am just absolutely elated when on the screen there's a big dragon or a knight in armor or a sword slashing is because I love that kind of storytelling where there's no cell phones anymore, no TVs, and we can actually have people interacting with each other. I love that. Even if they're, you know, using the sword on each other, at least they're interacting. I just like certain things, and you do too. You have delights. You have things you value and you treasure. Now, the psalmist wants to say there are things we can delight in that will undo us, and there are things we can delight in that will cause us to flourish. And what the psalmist wants us to delight in is God has spoken. God has given us guidance in the law. And not only that, the psalmist says, whose delights in the law of the Lord and who meditates on His law day and night. The idea of meditating is that when you delight in something, you just savor it. You chew it over, you reflect on it. When you really treasure and value something, you can't get enough of it. It is just something that you want to savor as much as possible. And the psalmist says they savor, meditate, day and night. Now, do you see the opposition? There's a walking, standing, and then sitting day and night with the scorners, with the mockers, with the ungodly counsel. Or there's the meditating day and night, delighting in what's virtuous and good and right and true, and making it one's food day and night. And when that's the case, the psalmist says there's a beautiful blessing that comes from this. Verse 3, that person is like a tree planted by streams of water. And if you were an ancient Israelite, the first thought that would come to mind is a tree planted by streams of water, tree of life. We're back in Eden. This is where paradise is found on earth. This person's like a tree. They're planted, they're rooted, they yield their fruit in season, their leaf does not wither, whatever they do prospers. The idea is there's such a fixedness, such a stability, such a security. Not because the tree has its own source of life, but because it's rooted in this stream of water next to it, the wisdom that enlivens it and fills it, of which it participates and savors. And that life flourishes. And the psalmist wants us to see that beautiful picture and then startle us by showing us the dead end. Verse 4, not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. So instead of being securely rooted like the tree by streams of life, the wicked are like chaff. Chaff is the outside parts of a grain that you pull off and you throw away. It comes to no value. It's not in any way meeting the end for which it's supposed to meet. And therefore, the psalmist says the wicked will not stand in judgment because we all will have to answer for our actions. There is a judgment. There is a sense in which the things we do, the choices we make, are not just ours to make, but they will come under the scrutiny of the God that has made us. And so the psalmist says there's a wise way, flourishing way, a life-filled way, and then there's a dead end. There's a way that leads to nowhere. And His ultimate blessing comes for us in the final verse, verse 6. The blessing He wants us to see, and you can connect this to the very first phrase, blessed is the one, verse 6, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous. You can scratch out the word watches because that's a horrible translation by the NIV, because the word is literally knows. It's yada. You ever watch Seinfeld? Elaine will say yada, 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 yada. Yada is the Hebrew word for know. And it's not just that you know about something, it's that you know intimately. It is Adam knew Eve and Cain was born. It is God through the prophet saying, Israel, of all the nations, only you have I known. And the idea is not that God doesn't know of all the other nations. It's like, wait, I'm surprised. There's Egypt and there's Assyria. How surprising. I didn't even know they were there. Instead, it is Israel's the one that has been loved, in which God has pursued this intimate relationship. So that knowing is the knowing of intimacy and love. And what the psalmist wants to do is say, here's the true blessedness. The divine gaze falls upon, with great approval and delight, those who delight in the law of God. Those who pursue the way of wisdom. that God savors that, that like a father looking over a well-behaved child, there's this gaze of approval instead of seeing the misbehavior and reading the final phrase, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. Now, I don't know what you want to do with that. I don't think this necessarily takes us all the way to issues of heaven and hell, but it does tell us something we know about life. There are choices that lead to flourishing, and there are choices that are destructive. There are foolish ways that lead to harmful ends for ourselves and for others, and there are wise ways that lead to flourishing lives for ourselves and for others. And that's what the psalmist wants to get across. There are dead ends. There is a skid row. There is a way to destruction, and he knows that because there's such a wonderful alternative for those who will seek it. Now, the reason that skid row, the road to nowhere, is a dead end is for one reason and one reason alone, and we're just about done. If we've been made in the divine image to know and be known by God, to love and to be loved by God, to love others in the name of God, if that's true, then the goal of all of our lives is to fulfill that for which we've been created, and that is to know and to love God and to be known by God. If that's the end of the maze, if that's the goal that we're to be shooting for, then every other goal, even though it might prosper for a moment, becomes a dead end because it doesn't lead to that end. It becomes a path that withers away or proves deceptive or, even worse, proves destructive. Perhaps these two quotes will help because they're essentially trying to communicate that which I've just said in the last 2 minutes. C.S. Lewis, God designed the human machine to run on himself. God is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, the food our spirits were designed to feed on. God cannot give us happiness and peace apart from himself because it's not there. There is no such thing. That there is no blessedness apart from God. To reject God, to go in the path of the scornful and the wicked, is to meet a dead end because there's nothing there. All that we've pursued, the choices that we've made, lead not to the goal for which we've been created, but instead to a dead end. Thomas Merton, who you may like him better than Lewis, I love them both equally, puts it this way. True happiness is not found in any other reward than that of being united with God. Same idea, we've been made by God for God. If I seek some other reward besides God himself, I may get my reward, but I cannot be happy. Let me say it in the best way I can as we come to a close. The reason why I like the word blessed, it's not happiness that makes us blessed. It's blessedness that brings happiness. It's knowing the blessing of God that brings that deeper joy and sense of meaning and security and peace. It's not happiness that makes us blessed because you can be a happy adulterer. You can be a happy thief. You can be a happy, again, you can fill in the blank. It's not happiness that makes us blessed. It is blessedness, being under the divine gaze with great approval and delight, that brings happiness. It is being able to hear like Jesus did from our Father, "This is my beloved child, in whom I'm well pleased," that really is the voice we long to hear. It is the end of the path that we're seeking to be on. Which leads to this conclusion. Proverbs and proverbial wisdom is very simplistic, sometimes overly simplistic, and I hope you note that. I'm not trying to simplify life, but for the sake of trying to give direction, you have to generalize, you have to be simplistic. Proverbs, and this psalm being an extended proverb, wants to show us simply two paths. Foolish, wise, life, death, blessing, curse, righteous, wicked. And it does that because anytime we read the Proverbs, we should be confronted with this question: which path are you on? Who are you hanging out with? Who are the influences? Who are you influencing? And in what way? In a wise way of blessing and justice and respect and dignity, or in a foolish way of destruction and harm and abuse? And that's one of the ways we can assess which path we're on. We can ask ourselves, like verse 1 does, with whom are we walking? And, you know, we have to walk in the world. But maybe you might ask yourself even further, with whom am I standing? Because I've just kind of got comfortable with these scorners and these mockers and this council. Or even worse, with whom have I just settled in? All this counsel, just what was harmful and destructive now is just embraced as, oh, this is just the truth. We need to realize that few plan to go the way of destruction. Few of them. Instead, like almost all of us, if not all of us, we just kind of drift into it. Like Dallas says, that, you know, first we're walking, and then we're over influenced, then we're standing, and then we're sitting, and before we know it, we're at a dead end. Because we failed to meditate on God's law, to reflect on God's beauty, to be like a tree rooted, to delight in that which is good and true and beautiful and wise. And the reason why we can drift is because even though God desires us to know the blessing of wisdom, God won't force it on us. We can choose another road. The options are endless. But what Proverbs does is it warns us there are roads that lead to dead ends. Last quote, and I pray. Lewis puts it proverbially so well with this one statement. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done."